drinks and sandwiches and all that sort of thing. Had a, you know, when two big football powers like that get together, Ohio State and the University of Oklahoma, and it was the first time I believe they'd ever met. It was great. It was a great atmosphere, man. It was really great. I could talk about college football for a long time. It's probably what I should be doing as a college football show. I know college football fairly well. 866-546-5254. That's 866-546-5254. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Please stay where you're at. I got a question for you. We're down toward the end of the show, and I meant to talk about this a little earlier. This is a serious question now. How attached to your cell phone are you? Have you heard this story? Just how attached to your cell phone are you? The reason I ask now is because a lot of people, believe this or not, are asking to be buried with their cell phones. That's right. We take them to the dinner table. We take them to the bedroom, the bathroom stall. But a lot of people, funeral directors say, are now being buried with their cell phones. And they say it's just a trendy thing to do. It's something that's on the upswing. Don't ask me why, as some people just said, it's because it's something that's you know, they're known for. People use their cell phones a lot, and it just seems perfectly normal to bury the cell phones with them. And there's a big, long story goes along with this. Some people have even placed iPod earphones on the decedent and play songs as the casket closed. Oh, God, what a story. And then people said, well, you know, it's just comforting to think that those things are still with them. She said, I've seen people leave cell phones on and tell me they're going to call their loved one later. I don't know if you'd get through her there or not. I don't know about that one. If I did that, if I requested that, it would be for a different reason. And you know what I'm talking about, like they did back in the, 1800s, put that little bell up above so you could ring it in case you were still, you know, that was before embalming and all that. How'd they get on this morbid subject? But, because back in the 1880s, there was this big fear, and they actually attached bells to the casket, so if a person woke up, they could ring the bell and let people know they weren't dead. But today, people take their cell phones with them because they're a part of them. Now, they don't cremate them, so if, you know, you got to do that, well, you're going to have to put the cell phone in there on top of the ashes after, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs of that deal, but you're going to have to, yeah, anyway. Hey, thanks so much for listening today here on the Guy James Show. It's a pleasure to have you with us, as always. It's a pleasure to be here on the Head On Radio Network. Looking forward to the inauguration next month. Going to be there. Going to do the show from there. I know you'll join us for that. You listen to the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network. Billy Shears, music director. And don't you dare forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.
The president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
Just don't put Mark Levine too far from his constitution.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
We do have secret prisons. That is not what America's all about.
And let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am your host, Mark Levine. And Congress is in session again. Now, I know you think you voted for a new Congress and a new president on November 4th, but you didn't. Well, you did, but they don't take office until January. Because of the Constitution of the United States, there is still one more session in December to be had, with still President Bush presiding over an old Congress, a Congress where the Senate is very, very close, 51-49 Democrats and Republicans. The House, the Democrats are in control, but by not near as much as they will be come January. So why are they meeting? Why aren't they going home for Christmas and waiting for the new Congress and the new president in January? Well, they have urgent business to attend to. According to General Motors, chief executives, its company will go bankrupt by the end of this month. That's right, it's December. It will go bankrupt in 23 days unless they get an emergency bridge loan from you and me, the American people. So there's no time to wait for a new President Obama. There's no time to wait for a new Congress. If this company is to be saved, well, I guess Congress has to act right now. Ford and Chrysler are in stronger positions than General Motors, but they're still having their troubles in this massive recession that we're facing right now and credit crunch. And according to the Washington Post, today's Post, we can show that on the screen, the White House says that a Detroit bailout deal is very likely today. But if we can show that up on the screen, there's a poll of Americans, and they were polled, and they showed that 54%. Can we show that up there? Let's show the Washington Post article if we could. There's a poll that shows that 54% of Americans oppose the deal. Only 37% support it. 10% are unsure. We'll see if we can get that graphic on the screen for you a little bit later on. To discuss this issue, I have to my right I have Gardner Britt. Now, he is, here it is, right here. You can see, gone again. There it is. Detroit bailout deal very likely today. And there's the poll on the right-hand side. A good 54% of Americans oppose the deal, even though it could mean that one of the big three auto companies in America could go bankrupt. Sitting to my right is Gardner Britt. Now, he is the owner, part of a family-owned business, of Ted Britt Ford. He's been in this business for 50 years. They're in Chantilly, Virginia, and they sell Ford cars. And Gardner Britt has come in to talk about what it's like on his side. And then sitting to my left is Melvin Carter. Now, he is a Virginia State Chair of the Community Action Program for United Auto Workers. Melvin Carter, thank you for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Glad to be here.
Well, obviously the question is, what should Congress do? And there's all kinds of proposals on the table from the President, from the Democrats, and, of course, there's Americans. 54% say we shouldn't do this deal. Let me start with you, Gardner. Should we do this deal?
I believe so, yes. Some help is needed to the big three, and although I'm on more of the local business side, it affects me greatly.
How does it affect your business?
Well, if GM, say if GM goes under.
Right. I mean, you're Ford, right? Wouldn't that help you? You're in the competition.
It's the public's perception in American manufacturers. If, say, if GM or Chrysler, I hope they don't, but I don't think they will, but if GM were to go under, people will start to think, I'm not going to buy an American car. Well, Ford's, GM's going to go under. When's Ford going to go under? And as you read from the article in the Post and seen on the news, Ford is definitely the healthiest of the three. They don't need a loan. We're just there for the support of Chrysler and of General Motors. And it definitely, if they don't get the loan, it affects the progress Ford's made the past 2 years.
Now, Mel, the unions, United Auto Workers, they support a deal too, right?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm.
Why do you need a deal?
Well, we have a large number of retirees. We have a growing workforce. Myself, I've been at GM for 29.7 years. And we have good workers, we have good products, and we've come a long ways.
I mean, what do you do at General Motors? I'm curious.
At General Motors, I'm a quality network person. It involves training, a lot of programs we have.
Quality
network.
Network
mm-hmm.
program. So you make sure that everyone makes good stuff and not bad stuff.
Right, that's part of my job also.
I see. Okay, so you both support the deal. It seems that President Bush and the Democrats are going to come to some sort of deal. We'll talk about in this hour about some of the differences between the two of them. President-elect Obama supports the deal, but the American people don't seem to. Why do you think the American people are reluctant to support a deal that both of you, on both sides of the fence, support, that both, still President Bush and President-elect Obama support, Congress seems to support? Why aren't the American people on board?
Well, from my point of it, the perception of it, a lot of people in the general public thinks that we make $70 an hour, which is not true.
The union workers
make a lot of money. And it's right now, I guess you heard about the job bank situation. Well, the job bank situation, a lot of people think that you sit home and get paid for not working. And that's not the issue.
What is a job bank?
Job bank was created, actually by the Japanese years ago, to keep you working. The job bank is designed to train you on another avenue if something should ever happen to your job, nursing, truck driving, or whatever. When you're laid off, you're supposed to go into a job bank, and you're supposed to get training for another job, whatever your choice might be, truck driving, computer.
So the UAW, if an auto worker is laid off, will actually train a worker to take on a new
right,
job.
Right, right.
And mm-hmm. the job bank is funded by workers who make part of their union dues.
Right, exactly.
So, do you have any problem with things like that?
No. I'm for the unions. I'm for the manufacturers. I think they're going to do a little bit of renegotiating. And but the average person does. That's all the media has been blasting lately, $77 an hour.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. Is $70 an hour, are union workers making $70 an hour?
Not on my paycheck, anyway.
Okay.
Actually,
What is the rate?
Average assembly worker makes $28 an hour.
$20 an
hour?
$28.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's still a far cry from
right.
$77.
And the skilled trades worker, which is be a mechanic, electrician, tool and die, craft person, we call them skilled trades, will make $33 an hour.
And of course, that's all pre-tax. It's less
right.
after tax.
As of last year, in the new contract, they started a two-tier wage system, whereas a new employee comes and will make half of what we make, half of the $20. They make $14 they're starting off with. That's your first tier. Where the $70-some dollars come in at is, it's actually, it was with the retirees' money rolled in, along with the workers' benefits, my benefits, your pension.
So you're talking about the money that the company owes to people who worked in the auto industry for 50 years,
right.
have already retired,
right.
have already put in their time, and are owed a certain amount of money by
right.
the company.
Exactly.
Well, why would that be included at all? Why wouldn't the company simply take the pension money that they owe all the retirees, stick it in a fund, don't touch it, they get that money, and then only worry about current
Well, workers. In the last contract, the retirees' health care and everything was rolled into another part of it to help ease that pension part of it, and it was called a VEBA, volunteer situation where the union handles the health care for the union workers now. That took a big cost off the table for the General Motors at that point.
So it actually would take the cost off the table.
Right.
We got a lot of issues, and we each have a call on the line. Before we get to him, though, let me just ask you, Gardner, what should the American public understand that they clearly, 54% of them, don't understand now?
I think it's how many jobs are affected, and what happens if General Motors goes
What
collapses.
Does happen? What happens in your business? You sell Ford cars. What
if,
would happen
if Ford were to collapse? The dealerships that would close down, the jobs in the community.
How many people do you employ? If you don't
mind we're right there, right under 400.
400? Just in your dealership?
Between two locations. And
then the people, they sell cars, they service cars.
They sell cars, the servicing cars, all the jobs that we provide, all the taxes.
Sure. And your fear is that if GM goes under, people will suddenly start buying Japanese, European cars, and they'll give up on Ford as well.
General Motors is certainly the largest auto manufacturer. If they collapse, then most likely Chrysler will. Then I don't like to think that Ford would, but, you know, GM's a pretty big player.
And to your company's credit, it is the strongest of the big three.
Yes. 2 years ago, Ford Motor Company, they started the whole turnaround. And they refinanced everything, including, I was told, hit the blue oval in Henry Ford's name.
What does that mean? I mean, why is your company so much stronger? What did Ford execs do that GM execs and Chrysler execs didn't do? Why is your company stronger?
We like to believe it's because we started this turnaround plan 2 years ago.
What does that mean, turnaround plan? I mean, to our listeners.
We started the newer products, more fuel-efficient products. We changed the truck. You know, everyone thinks of trucks.
Yeah, Ford trucks. That's the commercials, right?
We turned over to cars. You know, we've been going more after the car
so
market.
So more fuel-efficient. Do you have a hybrid?
We have a hybrid. We have one hybrid right now, the Ford Escape, which is the number one selling SUV hybrid.
What kind of mileage does that get?
It goes anywhere from 28 up. The new hybrid,
which is very good for an SUV. We can get cars that do better.
The 2000 in 2006 we came out with a Ford Fusion. It's going to go hybrid in 2010, which will get 8 miles better mile per gallon than the Toyota Camry. So we're very excited about the product lineup coming. The quality's never been better. Ford late this year has won this top safety award and the quality awards.
I still got a lot of questions for both of you in this hour and on the package, on why, frankly, you didn't do this sooner to these fuel-efficient cars. We'll go to all that, but first, I got to give my listeners a first crack at this. George from Fairfax, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. I got a question for both these guests of yours. Mr. Britt, I noticed about 10, 15 years ago, CNG as a fuel was widely available on the East Coast, 4 or 5 stations in Fairfax alone. In over that time, CNG is being phased out. Honda had available things. How did that affect your business? And to follow up on that, hydrogen is an available fuel for these vehicles. If Ford built hydrogen vehicles and required as part of your franchise that you fuel those hydrogen vehicles, wouldn't that bring back the business and bring cars back into your dealership for servicing, for repairs, and for fuel, and therefore bypassing the fuel industry? People like ExxonMobil,
I'll ask Gardner the question. First of all, CNG. You know about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell me what that is, and you can answer George's question there.
Well, a lot of people everybody wants more fuel-efficient vehicles. Everyone's looking for the latest technology. The whole hybrid craze. 6 months ago was wild. Small cars such as the Ford Focus, the Chevy Malibu,
right.
The Toyota Corolla. When gas was at $3-$4 a gallon, you couldn't find them. Now that gas, I believe most areas under $2 an hour or $2 a gallon, the dealerships are overwhelmed with inventory. So now that gas is down, hybrids aren't. At one time, people were fighting for the hybrids. But now the time, now hybrids are readily available.
Which is going to raise another question that I'll wait till after the break. It's going to be about a gas tax, maybe to
yes.
do that to actually. But we'll get to that after the break. I want to deal with George's other question, hydrogen.
It could definitely bring more customers.
Is the technology there? Can we make a hydrogen car?
Ford claims by 2010 we're going to have the first plug-in. As far as hydrogen, they haven't really let us as the dealers know about it.
But you don't think as of certainly 2008, December?
I don't see them anytime soon. I see all the manufacturers still working on the hybrid. I see the plug-ins coming. And in my opinion, I bet someone has one by late 2009 or 2010 Ford claim or plans to have.
Can we skip the break so I can give George a follow-up? Let's skip the break. First, Mel, what do you think about either CNG or hydrogen or any other kind of new technology for cars?
Well, I'm like him. Ford, Chrysler, and GM have all been working on a new battery for electric cars also. We're working on the Volt and the plug-in car, and that's due out before 2010. And they've speeded up the progress and availability of those have might by early 2010. So we're doing a lot of things. We have flex fuel cars. We have over a dozen cars. Well, that's getting 30 miles a gallon right now. Your Chevy Volt, your Malibu, even the Impalas are getting.
Okay, here's the thing. I mean, both of you gentlemen, you're talking about really sounds like good stuff coming a little bit now, 2009, maybe more in 2010. Shouldn't we have known this 30 years ago? I mean, Jimmy Carter was talking back in the 1970s. We need to have high fuel standards for cars. Japanese manufacturers, European manufacturers, they made lighter cars, better fuel-efficient cars. Mm-hmm. What's America's problem here? That's a tough question, I know. Who wants to take it first?
Well, to me, my perception is America have always been intrigued with gadgets, you know.
Can we put the gadgets in the hybrids?
And luxury, you know. A lot of people will forego the mileage for luxury.
Can't we get a luxury hybrid? I mean, even if the car metal is light, you can have plush leather seats, right?
There are one. There's the Tahoe. That's flex fuel, and that's SUV.
Okay.
So, and then not only gadgets, but I mean.
But what took us 30 years? I mean, it seems to me that America used to be in the forefront of innovation, mm-hmm. and now it seems like the Japanese and the Europeans have come ahead of us. Is it that our gas prices were too low and they had gas taxes, and so that jumped their manufacturers ahead of us?
I mean, I agree. It certainly is from a dealer's point of view. A lot of the dealers say, well, what's taking so long? They've just introduced Ford doesn't have a hybrid sedan. They've told the dealers now that we're coming out with one in 2010. I, as well as everyone else, you know, as soon as the public sees it on the Internet, you know, they want it now. I want it now. Mm-hmm. I agree. What's taking so long? I mean, I'm sure there's lots of planning, funding.
But why wasn't it done in the 90s? Why wasn't it done in the 80s?
80s.
I mean, like I said, in the 1970s, we had a massive oil shock. Jimmy Carter said, we need better efficient mm-hmm. cars. I remember they started saying, we don't need these big cars. We still don't have the boats from the 1970s mm-hmm. anymore. Mm-hmm. They started making them smaller. And then, I guess, under Reagan, the standards went down again, and you folks went back to old business. I mean, don't Americans have a right to say, hey, guys, mm-hmm. you didn't do the right thing 20 years ago. Maybe now that's why you're suffering.
I mean, if you also notice in the Washington Post, I mean, I think Wagner's, you know, quote,
the CEO of General Motors.
The CEO of General Motors was, you know, we've made some mistakes. We've built some of the wrong cars or didn't build them correctly. And sure, we all have, but I mean, the hybrid is a good craze right now, but a lot of Americans still want power. The trucking, I think of all the businesses that still need the diesel. I mean, diesel.
Well, obviously, whatever. If you got a truck, you have to have a
truck. Yeah, diesel.
Let me go. Our caller, George, has a follow up question. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, for your union representative, I was wondering, first of all, if he used one of the corporate jets to get there tonight.
No.
It seems to me, though, that and he's a GM rep, it seems, the Opel products fill a huge hole in General Motors' small car range. And they're very popular, very successful in other parts of the world. Why hadn't GM started manufacturing some of those here to compete with what is the small car market, the Asian market?
Great question. Mel, got an answer?
Well, for the corporate jet, they won't loan it to me.
Yeah, no, the union representatives can't use the corporate jet. That, right. I'm sure of that. But how about this question about the Opel? I mean, here you have a car that's working in Europe.
Right.
You have GM already making it, mm-hmm. apparently, in Europe. Right. Why are they making it here?
And actually, we have designs now to use some of the technology here in the United States right now on some cars. As you know, we build a lot of engine factories in Asia, Thailand, places like that. And eventually we're going to be doing the same thing here and use this small car segment. We have some cars, and Santa has a small car, the Astra, which is a small car, basically compatible with the Opel. So we do have some cars in the market coming out to compare with that.
What is Gardner right, Mel, when he says Americans, I mean a few, you know, I guess liberals, Democrats, they want those hybrids, environmentalists, but a lot of Americans just want those big, powerful cars and they won't buy them. Is that true?
Well, I think so, too. A lot of people fell in love with the SUVs. It's SUV crazy. They got away from station wagons.
Why did they fall in love with the SUVs?
Well,
was
family.
It advertising? I mean, we used to have station wagons back in the 70s.
Yeah.
I remember. That's how my mom drove us. Around?
Well, to me, SUVs take up the place of two vehicles. You have a station wagon, you have a tow vehicle. You can store stuff, you can carry stuff. And that kind of took off and took hold. Personally, myself, I like SUVs. I tow motorcycle trailers, I tow boats. So
it's a hard find parking in the District of Columbia with an SUV, I can tell you that.
Yeah, it is that. But
here's my question. I mean, it seems to me the whole world is going in one direction, and America is going in another direction. You have Europe and Japan. They all have much smaller cars than we have.
Right.
Their biggest cars are like our smallest cars.
Right, exactly.
You know, they can fit into tight parking places.
Mm-hmm.
They have, high gas taxes. Right. They have public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And they are designing, it seems, fuel-efficient cars for the next century.
Right.
Are they the future? Do we need to get more like Japan and Europe?
Well, actually, we need entry-level cars. And that's been my thing a lot of times. That's, I think, one of the general mistakes, too. We got kind of away from entry-level cars. We'll take an entry-level car and we'll start adding on. We'll make it a little bit bigger. Okay, now you need a little bit more power, so you put a turbo on.
Yeah, you got a kid out of college, and you need to have an inexpensive car.
Right.
And can't you just make light metal that's inexpensive?
The majority of it now, we use fiberglass and carbon fibers and stuff like that. You have to look at safety regulations, exactly.
Well, okay, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm told that these cars you're making in Europe and Japan, that you can have light metals that are safe, too. I mean, is
well,
that right?
That is very correct. I agree. Small cars are very popular now. You know, the old days of, you know, bigger the SUV, the better. Ford's even quit making one of the products, the Ford Excursion, which was the largest SUV it made. But there's still a need for the families.
Who makes the Hummer? That's GM.
That's GM.
But y'all
are
getting rid of that, right?
Yes, trying to sell that, yes.
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's true, but still, what about the families? I grew up in a family of seven boys. We're certainly not going to, you know, jump in a little European sedan. America, the needs are going to more cars, but there still is that need for SUVs, and that's where, you know, as a dealer...
Do they have to be that big? I mean, can't they be wider and so forth without being so high off the ground and using all that extra metal that frankly makes the fuel efficiency so low?
Some people, everyone's different. Some people like our consumers, some people want the biggest, biggest thing possible, and some want just the best gas mileage. As a dealer's point of view, I think they just need to get better gas mileage.
I tell you, I look at this question kind of as a policymaker. I'm an ex-staffer in Congress. You know, I look at it as how can we design a policy that moves us forward for the next 100 years. I don't think we can keep taking oil from Saudi Arabia and China and Venezuela and all these dictators and having, frankly, them own our destiny.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at more fuel-efficient cars and convincing Americans, frankly, even if they want the bigger cars, that this isn't best for them. Here's a proposal I have that Bush won't support, Obama won't support, and the Republicans and the Democrats won't support, but I think is the right idea. A gas tax. Not when gas is $4 a gallon, but right now gas is $1.85. I don't think either of you can say this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What if we were to put in a $1 a gallon tax and say this? If the price gets to be above $3, we can lower the tax. So in other words, Americans will never have to pay, say, over $3.50. So we can actually lower the tax. But basically make the price, say, $3.50 a gallon, something like that. We can give rebates back to people. I mean, we're not trying to keep the money for other uses. We'd actually give it back to people who spend it. But the idea is to persuade Americans, the way the Japanese and Europeans have, that oil and Humvees and cars that get 10 miles a gallon, that's just not the way for the future. Well, can I get either of you on record supporting that? I doubt it, but
I'm not supporting. I'm not.
What do you think?
It's interesting. It's certainly something.
It's interesting.
Certainly something to look into.
I don't blame you. It's not a very popular proposal. I'll admit that for the first hand. No.
Your proposal is similar to the luxury tax on vehicles, but only you're doing it with gas.
Well, the idea is to convince people to get the smaller cars, and frankly, as you pointed out, Gardner. When gas was $4 a gallon, people were crowding your shop saying, where's my hybrid?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's at $1.85. They're playing with us, right?
It's back and forth, back and forth.
And if you do that, I'll tell you a story from a psychological experiment. I told this to my listeners just the other day. They do these things where they give rats a meal, and they have to push a lever to get the meal. If they push the lever to get the meal, and it always comes. That was one thing. And if they push it three times and it gets it, it comes. They did this experiment where it sometimes came and it sometimes didn't. They pushed the lever, it sometimes came. That rat would keep pushing that lever until he died. Uh-huh. To me, they're doing that with us in gas prices. It's like, oh, we'll raise it up to four, and then just when you're hurting, just when you're trying to change your fuel vision, it goes down to $1.85. And now you won't ever get to a new vision. You won't ever get there. You'll go back to Humvee. Oh, jack it up. $5 next summer. It always seems to happen in the summer. Congress is saying to the auto workers, enough is enough. Obama is saying it too. We need to have fuel-efficient cars for the 21st century. And if we're going to give you this loan, there's going to be conditions. And one of the major conditions is requiring the auto companies to move in the more fuel-efficient directions. Is that fair?
Oh, yes. I mean, I believe so. And keep in mind, I'm coming from more of the dealer, so I can't speak really on the factory side. But I want more fuel-efficient cars because I know that's what the public wants. And all the listeners and customers, they want more fuel-efficient rides. And being the dealer, I want that because I want to provide my customers what they like. But I do think it's fair to – they need better vehicles, and they need them now. And they need to get the game plan, and I like to see it because the big three got to hang around, and too many jobs are at stake here, and we need that, and it's good for the economy.
Mel, is that fair? Is that a fair deal?
It's a fair deal, but I prefer to see them built in the United States.
Well, sure.
Yeah, that's one of my stipulations. I would like to see better, you know, gas mileage cars being built, technology being built, but I want to see it here. I want to see it done here in the United States.
Is there a provision, or is UAW fighting for a provision in this bill to make sure the cars are built in the United States?
We made some concessions. We have. I mean, like the two-tier weigh system, and I'm sure it's going to be more concessions. You know, we may see, I don't want to say because I don't want to put it out there what we may lose, but I'm sure in this bridge loan, we're going to have to give up something to get what we want, and that's jobs back in the United States.
Well, I'll tell you, I looked at the Washington Post article, and I didn't see anything in there about requiring where it's produced. Right. Is that something that the UAW is putting forward, saying, hey, you know, we'll agree to be part of this deal, but they should be made in the United States?
Well, that's what my union is hoping for anyway, at least.
We got another call on the line, Saeed from Centerville. Saeed, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Yes, thanks for your show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for calling.
Okay, let me make it simple as a clear. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I live in Europe. I have lived in North Africa. And I come to the States almost 21 years ago. And I love American-made vehicles.
You do?
American citizen.
The big, inefficient fuel SUVs, you love them.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Hold on a second. I love American-made. I like Ford, I like etc. But my problem is, why American-made, they all the time have a problem? I bought a vehicle from Teddy Bradford right there in Fairfax, Virginia.
Uh-oh.
All the time. I have difficulty bring my vehicle. I have difficulty to repair. Before the warranty kick in, I bought a brand new Ford van, 1992. I have all the problem until I lost it, sell it back to the vehicle.
Okay, well, let me give Gardner a chance to defend himself. Thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. You know, obviously...
I want to buy American-made. What I try to say, I appreciate. What I want to buy a made in America. I want American vehicles to last.
It's a fair question. Let me ask you, there is a general perception out there. And, you know, I frankly, from my own anecdotal experience, and I didn't get a car, if you're a dealer, it was a GM car. But the Japanese cars, Americans believe, and I think there's some anecdotal evidence to spare this out. I can say in my own case, they're better made, they're less likely to need repairs than the American cars. And as an American, I'd love to buy American too, but there is this perception out there that it's just not made as well. Is that fair or is that unfair?
It's definitely unfair.
Okay.
I mean, first of all, Saeed, I appreciate you purchasing an American-made vehicle, especially at Tempered Ford. Thank you for that. But the perception of why the Japanese have better quality vehicles, I don't understand it. Maybe it's because I've always been in the American company. But equality. That's why I was telling you last year. You know, just this year alone.
I mean, are there statistics? Can you give? I say we have to take a break. But when we come back, I want you to give me some independent source that says, you know what, Ford, they actually do as good as Toyota or Hyundai.
You're blessed.
I want to hear those statistics. Also, want to hear from you if you want to call in. Here's your chance to put a dealership and a union on the hot seat, asking questions about this bailout. 888-488-MARSH. 888-488-6275. Be right back after this.
This is firstgov.gov, where we're obsessed with getting you government information.
Brand new student loan applications on the site, baby. This calls for a celebration.
So in the end, it was either take the astronaut gig or come work here. What can I say? Duty called.
Dude, that's my cop.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that's Sam's cop.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah. No. Sam's. No.
Just log on or email us and get what you need.
C, change address form. That's how it's done.
D, driver's license renewal.
Oh. E, emailing social security information.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Guys, hold on. All right, Ed.
What are those?
Government surplus cars for auction.
You posted those online last time.
No, you did.
I'm posting them online this time.
For all your government information, firstgov.gov.
Oh, what have we got here? Sometimes you feel tired. You can't seem to lose those extra pounds off your midsection. And your joints hurt when you take the stairs. Well, you're getting older. But I'm happy to say that there's some simple things we can do to keep you happy and healthy for years to come. We can also lower your risk for some serious diseases the older population is often subject to. Proper nutrition is more important than ever. Your body has changed, you know. Not as many treats. A basic exercise plan. Lots of walks and fresh air. And most importantly, come and see me for twice yearly checkups to help ensure the best possible quality of life. Now, how does that sound? Good boy.
Skip the last break.
Improve the quality of life for your elderly pet. Schedule twice yearly checkups that include preventive care and regular lab work. The message from the veterinary members of the American Animal Hospital Association.
We'll give them a new van.
Yeah, right. This guy.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We are discussing cars, specifically American cars. I like American cars. I don't know why I'm sneezing at the mention of them. Apologize for that. But actually, that is the problem. The guy to my right, Ted Britt, is part of a family-owned business for 50 years. His name is Gardner Britt. He's with Ted Britt Ford. On my left sits Mel Carter. He is the Virginia State Representative, Community Action Program for United Auto Workers. And we're talking about American cars, the perception of them, the fuel efficiency, also about the bailout program. Do we need it? Should we have it? Gardner, I got to give you a chance to respond because our previous caller, Saeed, attacked you, your business, and I want to give you a chance to respond. I should say this. We had another caller after Saeed call in, and she said that she bought three cars from Ted Britt, from Ted Britt Ford, and she was not affiliated with your company. I checked. And one is at 132,000 miles, and two are over 125,000. So she's doing well. Saeed, though, may have gotten a little bit.
And Saeed, I mean, that's great that Saeed called. I don't think he was attacking me personally or my business. And he said several times he loves American cars.
Right.
I think he's a little frustrated with some of the experiences he may have had with the maintenance on the vehicle.
But there is this perception that American cars are not as well built as Japanese or European cars. Where does that come from, and why is it unfair?
I think for a certain time, maybe in the 90s and in the early 2000s, cars. I mean, General Motors, Ford. Ford was trucks. And while we had some cars, they never really focused on the luxury. I mean, Toyota came out with Lexus.
Yeah, but this isn't a question of luxury. This is a question of cars breaking down, right?
Show me the facts. But, right. I mean, I have all
Saeed, my... Saeed, if you find Gardner Britt, he actually did say in the break that he would address your specific situation. Give him a call, and he'll help you with your car. Mel, let me ask you this. Why is that perception out there, and why is it unfair?
Well, I really think that we've got a bad rap over the years because a few things happened in the past. But I'm involved in quality. Symphony's new Malibu is one of the best-made cars possible. The Ford Fusion is a very nice car. We've been a long ways in quality. I've been to some of the proving grounds, the tests that they perform, the crash tests, the rollover tests, every test they make on them. And I personally buy a GM, and I'll buy a GM with 200,000 miles on it just as easy as I want with 50,000 miles.
Now, there are independent tests that show GM, Ford competing with Toyota or Honda or Nissan?
Oh, yeah. I'm for General Motors as I am for, I'm stronger for Ford, but I'm definitely backing the American manufacturer. The American-made cars have come such a long way, and the public has that perception, and that's why I'm big on
what should the companies do?
Marketing. They need to switch to marketing.
So they need to tell people about these
like
surveys.
They tell me.
Let's say, here's a survey that shows that Toyota broke down more than Ford.
And they need to. Like Ford and General Motors last year had fewer recalls than Toyota and Honda.
Really?
Yeah.
Now that's an important fact that most
Americans don't know. Ford is the safest vehicle on the road right now.
We've got a bunch of people on the line. Bonnie from Fairfax, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. I'm calling again about the quality of American-made cars, and the only thing I can really speak of is my experience with Fords, and I haven't had the best luck with Fords.
When did you buy your car, Bonnie?
Oh, my very first car was a Mustang, and we're talking about back in the 60s.
But the one that had the bad quality, when did you buy that one?
Okay, I'm sorry, when?
Yeah, you said there was a Ford car you had that didn't have good quality.
Not just one. Now, the Mustang was a used car, okay?
And that was in the 1960s. We can't really
right,
blame our guests
for
that one.
But I had a new Tempo, and I had a new
just give me an idea when those were bought.
And
the 80s?
Escort.
The 90s?
I believe it was in the 80s and 90s.
Okay. Have you bought a car in the O's in this decade?
I only buy Toyota now.
Oh, see, you lost the customer in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. I have found such a difference because they go forever, and it doesn't require any maintenance other than your routine maintenance. I haven't had any problems. I had a Previa. I have a Prius now, and I like the hybrids.
Thank you for your call, Bonnie. I mean, I think Bonnie's experience is not atypical. People bought American cars in the 80s and 90s. They weren't maybe as good in those decades, and they don't know that you're doing better right now.
Oh, I mean, the Tempo and Escort, obviously, they're not in production anymore. Ford's improved their quality, just like Toyota and Honda are working to improve their quality.
She also wants a hybrid, too.
All vehicles need maintenance.
You gotta have an oil change.
All vehicles gotta have oil changes, and all vehicles need maintenance. I don't care if it's American made or Japanese made. General Motors as well as Ford have made big strides of improvement. And
let me move on to the more general question, though. Mm-hmm. Everyone can give me a car story, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The specific question, though, is what's coming before Congress, and that's coming this week, really. And there's a bill. The auto CEOs came, the big three, they came in their corporate jets, they asked for $25 billion, and Congress basically laughed at them and said, you're coming in your corporate jets, you're asking for $25 billion, what do you think we are, Santa Claus? And said, go away and give us a realistic plan. Then they came back and they said they needed $34 billion, but at least they came without their corporate jets, they drove in their American-made cars. Now it seems the deal that they're proposing is not the big deal, $34 billion, it's a $15 billion bridge loan. A loan that the government expects to be paid back, or actually the taxpayers, we're getting a decent return, 5% on our money. Mm-hmm. That's not easy to get these days. Right. And after 5 years, if you folks don't pay it back, it goes up to 9%, which is a very good deal for the taxpayers. They're going to appoint a single czar, a car czar, as I said to my producer, not a Kaiser, but a car czar, to watch over it. Is this the way to go?
I think so. You have to have guidelines. And some of the guidelines is that you have to be, someone has to have control over your money. With the bridge loan, a lot of people think that they're giving us money, we want to pay it back. When Christ was in a bind years ago, they loaned Christ the money, and the United States made money off of Christ, and they paid it back ahead of time. We have proposed to pay the money back by 2010, and it's going to come from concessions that we give up, concessions that the CEOs...
Concessions that unions give up.
Right, and the CEOs will have to give up some this time also.
Okay, but the UAW chairman, I heard Ron Gettelfinger, right?
Right.
I heard him come on TV and say, hey, the unions, we've given enough over the years. We shouldn't be asked to give more concessions. What do you think?
Well, last week, after that statement, they had a meeting in Detroit, and they called all the union officials up, And they told him that if necessary, we're going to still have to go back into the contract and do some changing. And that could involve anything. It could involve wage cut. It could involve more two-tier wage systems or whatever. You know, but we have to do some concessions.
But let me ask you this. Now, here's what I don't understand. The reason that the car industry is in trouble today,
right.
it's, they didn't build the fuel-efficient cars they should have done for 10, right. 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's also, let's face it, it's the general economy. I mean, we are facing the greatest depression since the Great Depression.
Exactly right.
November was the worst spending month in some 30 years, even though it's right before the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
We have a huge credit crunch where people are, you know, it's hard to buy a car without using credit. And these things are causing, these sort of external things, which have nothing to do with your workers and how good a job they do, they're causing the problem. Why should unions have to give up anything if it's these external pressures? I mean, it's not your workers are making bad cars. Apparently, at least this decade, America's doing quite well with quality.
Right, exactly. Well, it's, and 4 years ago, we had 333,000 UAW Chrysler employees. Now we're down to 135,000 workers. So we've given up things over the years. The SAP program, the buyout, the General Motors bought off the older employees to make room for the new lower wages to help bring the costs back. Labor's only 10% of the average vehicle cost.
But that's important. Only 10% of the vehicle cost is labor.
Right.
So if you got a car that sells for $25,000 and you paid your workers nothing, you could only sell that car for $22,500.
Right.
Now, that's interesting, because, Sean Hannity and all the other ones seem to think, make you think that the reason we're not competitive is because union shops.
And they
But let me ask you this. I mean, Toyota and Honda, these are non-union places, they have a lot of places down south, unlike in Detroit, and I assume they don't pay their workers like you folks do. How much of a savings does that give them?
It's only a couple of dollars difference between Toyota wages and our wages. And the difference would be our pension plan we have. Okay, and it's been years that they've made more money than we have with the percentage they get on their profit sharing. We went years without profit sharing because we decided to give it up to protect the pension of our retired workers and the health care. So we gave concessions. That was some of the concessions we gave up. The wages are not that far apart. And like I say, the biggest cost in the car is your research, your marketing, and your probably destination charges and stuff like that. That's where
how much of it goes to the wages of the executive, the CEOs, and the board members, of the board of directors, and the management.
I don't know the exact figure, but last week in Congress, it was talking. CEO John Moses said was $16 million a year.
$16 million is what he made. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. First of all, should the unions have to pay a price? I mean, this isn't their fault, is it?
I think it definitely needs to be some restructuring.
Now, what does that mean? Restructuring. That's a nice big word that covers up a lot of stuff. Who has to pay? Whose hide does it come from?
I think it's definitely unfair if Toyota and Honda can come down south. Alabama, Senator Shelby, the one who's been very vocal.
Yeah, now he's the most vocal member of Congress against this deal.
But he was also the same individual who begged for Toyota and Honda. I don't know if it's Toyota, Honda, Mercedes, Hyundai, come build plants to their state to help bring jobs.
Exactly. So it's unfair to put this all
It's unfair here. Because he's, don't think Toyota and Honda aren't having problems. The whole credit crunch, the economy is definitely down a little, so all of the manufacturers are down. I mean, Toyota sales are down over 20%. Honda's sales last month were, I think, 23%. All sales are down.
And that's because of the general economy.
It's the general economy. It's hard to get people to fund it.
We have another caller, Mike from Centerville. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you for having me on the program. You're focusing on the wrong thing. The real issue is the credit markets have shut down. In 2006, GM sold over $100 billion in bonds. They can't sell $1 million in bonds in this current market, let alone a billion. It's not they need money. It's the financial system. The Goldman Sachs treasurer and CEO thinks the solution is give all the money to Wall Street, let it trickle out. They're missing the big picture of the individual companies, and I think they should bail it out, and I think your survey is reflected more of the people opposition to the bailouts in general than to Ford or GM in particular. That's a major issue.
I think you make a very good point, Mike, a very strong point. It isn't because suddenly Americans aren't buying cars anymore. People may complain about an individual car. Credit crunch.
He's exactly right, and people are coming into the store trying to buy cars, but the banks just aren't there. A year ago, I had over 30 banks that worked with our company. Several banks are closing their doors and raising their standards.
Can you provide, you know, the kind of financing that car dealerships have to provide?
Oh, yes.
Most people can't afford to plunk down $30,000 for a car. They're going to need to have some kind of loan. You've got financing.
More than half of the customers don't even put any money down. There's still financing.
Is it more expensive than it used to be, the financing? How does the credit crunch affect you?
The standards are higher. The customers have to have a higher beacon score.
I see. They need a higher credit score.
A higher credit score.
So some customers who could get credit before can't get credit now.
Exactly.
Same problem on your end? Big credit problem?
Same thing. General's at GMAC.
Right. General Motors financed its own credit. Right. It doesn't have that anymore?
GMAC was doing bad also. It was looking to sell it off because of the beacon score and people not affording the payments on it.
So what do you do when a person who could afford a car before can't afford it now? Do you just have to turn them away?
That's unfortunate. You know, back a year or two ago when everyone's buying houses and everyone's buying cars, no money down, just roll it. Mm-hmm. You know, now the customers are coming in trying to buy cars and the bank's saying, oh, we require this amount of down.
How significant is the difference? I mean, give me an idea. It's hard to judge with numbers. Before, 90% of your cars could get credit, of your customers could get credit. Now it's what?
It's definitely, I mean, my sales are down over 20%.
No, I'm just trying to get an idea on the credit.
It's hard to put an exact figure on. I mean, you do see it a lot more.
You don't have to turn away half your customers.
No, not even close.
Okay, but maybe a good 20%, something like that.
I'd say maybe. It could be a possibility.
Okay. We have a question on the blog. Wants to know if General Motors and Ford donated $10 million each after 9/11, while Toyota and Honda didn't. So the blogger is making the point that General Motors and Ford, American companies, helped in the 9/11 effort.
That's interesting. I just read about that I think it was last week. Ford and General Motors donated hefty amounts of money, donated vehicles. They gave up some of their, real estate in New York to help with the on-site locations. Mm-hmm. Toyota, Honda, BMW,
Porsche,
nothing.
Yeah, the foreign cars, nothing.
Even Harley Davidson gave up motorcycles and stuff to the department.
New York City Police.
Now, let me get back to the issue of labor, because you make a very interesting point that only 10% of a car's cost is its labor. You know, again, you just do the math, right? A $20,000 car would still cost $18,000 if you paid your workers nothing.
Right.
Nobody wants that. But when you know, Henry Ford once famously said, I have to pay my workers enough so they can buy my Model Ts.
Right.
He was saying that if I pay my workers, you know, the kind of wages you pay in Thailand or Mexico, something like that, then they can't afford to buy the product. What happens if, God forbid, General Motors, even Ford and Chrysler, the big three, go bankrupt, and these workers are thrown out of the business? How does that affect the overall general American economy?
All three of them, like, I think the figure, together employed nearly 5 million individuals.
5 million people, and that's not the dealership. That includes the dealership.
That includes dealerships, some of the parts suppliers.
Parts suppliers.
So 5 million Americans were to lose their job.
Right.
I mean, that's...
That's a great depression. I'll tell you this. In that same poll, the same poll that said that 54% of Americans oppose this bailout, and I think Mike Centerville has a really good point, which is people are just sick of bailouts, and they're not really making the difference between auto and financial and so forth. Yeah. But in that same poll, 15% of Americans said that the failure of the auto industry would affect them immediately.
Oh, yes.
Exactly.
Definitely.
15%
one out of every 10 person. The average is one out of every 10 person.
Yeah, and this is actually, this poll would even be one out of six.
Right.
See, I mean, who advertises heavily on TV, car dealerships,
right? Sure.
Auto manufacturers.
I hear commercials all the time.
Imagine if there's
some
no
are
TV.
Better than others. Anyway.
Imagine if no car commercials, you know, from the local level or the national level on TV. How many TV stations are going to close?
Right.
I mean, it affects everybody in one way or another.
Now, Mel, you made the really good point that Chrysler, we bailed them out a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
They not only paid every penny back, but the American taxpayer made money, and they got it paid back early. It's interesting because our government has already agreed to $700 billion for these financial institutions, and they've already told us, you know, we probably won't get a lot of it back.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get some of it back, but we won't get all of it back. Do you believe the American autos, the big three, will pay back every penny just as Chrysler did?
I do. I really do. And I'm sure that we have to do it to show the American public that we are good for our word and we're going to do this. And I don't think our union leaders will have any other way either. And like I say, we would make concessions. It was just like Chrysler employees made concessions back in the day. No profit sharing, no raises, no anything until that loan was paid back. And we're willing to do the same thing, I'm sure, if it comes to that.
And management has to make concessions, too. The Democrats have said, if we give this deal, then management has to agree on no bonuses, shareholders get no dividends, nothing until it's all paid back. Is that fair?
I mean, I don't think Congress told them. I think they all volunteered. Well, on Ford's side. Ford said they weren't going
to... Right now, to be fair, they're discussing a potential deal. This is one of the things the Democrats said that they wanted, and I think you're right. I think
being a taxpayer's money, yes, it is fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, the goal is to get the big three healthy.
They seem to have gotten it the second time around when they drove from Detroit to Washington. But what were they thinking when they came here in their corporate jets? Are they completely tone deaf to how Americans see this?
I personally, I mean, then again, I'm not the factor.
I understand. I personally
don't think what the jets made a decision at. How does Nancy, the Speaker of the House, I certainly remember reading an article in Washington Post that as soon as she began to
go,
she had to get a bigger jet because she didn't want to stop to refuel. I mean, I don't know if that's accurate, but
I don't know if that's true either. Let me ask you, though, specifically about the program. Mm-hmm. There is some difference between Bush and the Democrats mm-hmm. on where the money was to come from. Mm-hmm. Bush insisted that it come out of a pre-existing $25 billion plan mm-hmm. that already requires, it's supposed to help auto manufacturers to fuel-efficient cars.
Future.
Now, the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats, wanted to say, no, we think this money should come out of the $700 billion, the financial money. Mm-hmm. And Bush effectively said, no, we want to rob the fuel efficiency program, the program that's persuading American auto manufacturers, giving them the money they need to make us more like Japan, and we want to make less fuel-efficient cars to bail them out. The Democrats fought Bush on this, but basically said, look, GM says it's going to go out of business by the end of the year. We've got to do it. Mm-hmm. We'll agree, but we'll replenish that fund later. I mean, do you have any sympathy for Bush saying it has to come from a fuel efficiency program? That seems like, I don't know, who would want that? Oil companies?
They are building. I mean, first of all, Ford, GM, we're not trying to build vehicles like Toyota. We're trying to build vehicles better.
Okay.
And second of all, I mean, whether the money comes from the $700 billion where the Democrats want, or from the, I guess they call it an investment fund where, you know,
for the fuel efficiency
fund. General Motors needs it right now. And where it comes from, I don't necessarily...
They can replenish the money.
They can replenish the money either
way. Well, and that's why the Democrats look like they're going to give in on this part. The other thing they're talking about is this Karzar. Mm-hmm. And he or she is going to be appointed by George Bush. But interestingly, the Congress is going to not really give the Karzar a lot of power until February 15th after Barack mm-hmm. Obama can install his own right. man or woman there. But the Karzar apparently is going to look at the program, can pull it back, maybe even push the country and push the companies into bankruptcy. You trust Barack Obama to pick the right person to do that?
Yeah, I do. I'm very pleased with
all that. It's a lot of power in one person.
Right.
I mean, is that scary at all? Does that scare you at all, the Karzar?
It's scary, but you know, we just got to support them. And
at this point, you really don't have any choice.
Don't have any choice.
You just got to take what you can get. Right. Let me talk about another man who may or may not have a choice, and that is the CEO of your corporation, right. Richard Wagner.
Right.
He is the head of General Motors, and he got his head handed to him by Chris Dodd, the Democratic senator who's the chairman of the banking committee.
Mm-hmm.
He basically said, Mr. Wagner, your time is up. You need mm-hmm. to go. You agree with Senator Dodd?
Well,
kind of hard to say, Sam. When you're a union rep from GM,
right, we are,
and that should ask the Ford
right.
guy.
And then I think,
let me ask you this in general.
Right.
How has Wagner performed, or can you not even say that?
Yeah, he's been okay. I mean, he's got a lot of cars in the system, a lot of programs, everything going on. But I just can't lay the blame right on one person, on Rick Wagner. I mean, it's a lot of other things involved in it, you know, maybe some decision making other than him. Maybe the design on the cars may not have been. Like you said, cars might be too late coming out, but you really can't blame him for all of that, you know. And to be fair, I think we need to just step back and see how these new arrangements can work out.
I'll tell you one thing I appreciated, all three CEOs saying that in the second go-around that they would each take a dollar a year until everything was fixed. What do you think about CEO Rick Wagner?
I think he's been there since 1977, I believe, so he's... must be doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think he's a very wise man.
I didn't think he'd been there that long. But
he's been there a long time. I know that
CEO.
He's been a long time. Or not, maybe not.
I think he's been CEO since 2000.
He's been
GM since 1977.
And I think he's a very smart individual. For a dollar a year, I think it shows their commitment to making.